The next one, we're going to get onto some engineering things. So we've done some vulnerability curves. Daniel Smith is going to talk about sort of the engineering side of that. So Daniel is a research fellow with the Cyclone Testing Station at James Cook University in Australia and a consultant faculty member at the University of Florida. So he's got some good parallels and good experience there. His current work in the US and Australia covers a wide range of topics, including structural mitigation for hurricanes, post-event damage assessment, and here comes that word again, field deployed anemometry, measuring wind speed. So I'm assuming it's a bit like that 1996 classic documentary with Bill Paxton in called Twister, where you drive around in a truck. And anyway, I can't remember what happened, but I'm sure they got the wind speed out of it. Vulnerability and fragility modeling, retrofitting for water and wind, water ingress and wind, behavioral aspects of community cyclone preparedness. So we start to see the themes coming through here, and insurance claims analysis. Daniel is also a co-founder and developer of Resilient Residents, a software application tool that aims to promote mitigation by enabling homeowners to self-assess vulnerability of their home to wind-related damages. So Dr. Daniel Smith has also contributed to several research projects and delivered by the Bushfire and Natural Hazards CRC. So Daniel, you'd like to come? Thank you very much.
Okay, so thank you for having me. Thanks, Jeremy, for the introduction. So I grew up in Florida. I experienced quite a few hurricanes there, and that's kind of where the interest started. I studied at the University of Florida, and then I moved to James Cook University 4 years ago, and really started looking at a lot of the same problems that we were addressing in Florida when it comes to cyclone risk, mitigation, older versus newer structures, really a lot of the same issues were coming up, and it was just uncanny, the same questions that we were asking when I started working in Australia as well. And so in recent years, I've really kind of started looking at the parallels between the two places and trying to figure out ways to not duplicate work and figure out ways to solve the problems collaboratively. So I'm going to talk about focusing on Queensland, some of the mitigation research that we're doing, but I'm going to sprinkle in some Florida and U.S. Comparisons just to kind of give you some context for the global nature of the issue, which you would all know already anyways. But before I do that, I'm going to do a little bit of a test, and I want to see by show of hands whether this is a cyclone damaged building in Florida or Australia. So go ahead. If you think it's Australia, raise your hand. All right, so this one's actually Florida. And it was actually a spin-off tornado that came off the northeast quadrant of Hurricane, this one's Irma, which was just in September of 2017. So a lot of windborne debris. Some of the rafters from the buildings in the background there came off, got ripped off, and then actually came through the building, through the wall, grabbed a telephone or electrical cord, and then came out the other side. And that's what you're seeing in the main photo there. But bottom right, that's impact-resistant glass on those doors. And actually did really, really well. They're not meant to keep from breaking, so they do still break, but they keep that debris from coming in and allowing that opening to completely break and cause internal pressure inside the building, which is a pretty big issue that I'll talk about coming up here in a second. We don't see impact-resistant glazing as much in housing here in Australia, so that's one of the things that we could potentially learn from in the U.S. in terms of mitigation. And so this one here, Queensland, raise your hand. Yeah, you guys are getting better. So this is Cyclone Marcia, 2015 in Yeppoon area. Really, really devastating for this homeowner. Just 6 months before this, brand new roof that ended up in the neighbor's backyard. Really good connection, solid cladding, really pretty roof. They did a great job of attaching the roof to the battens, which are the blue lines that you see there, down to the rafters. So where those green circles are, they did a really good job. But unfortunately, they didn't connect the or upgrade the roof-to-wall connections, which are the rafters that you see in red. So they missed one link in the chain, and this entire roof basically became sail and just unzipped. It was a really, really sad story. And this one here, if you think it's Florida, raise your hand. That's a true question. This one's Texas. So this was Harvey, August in 2017. As you would know, it was a pretty big season in the U.S. and U.S. Virgin Islands last year. So we were actually on the ground, and we did some assessments for this one as well. And the interesting thing about the analysis in Texas is that a lot of the construction styles are similar to North Queensland. So you get the Queenslander style house elevated on piers with that kind of breakaway lower story. And this one really was just age connections at the floor down at that foundation level on the top story. The wind picked up and actually just ripped the entire wall and roof away from this building. It's really just poor maintenance, lack of strapping, that kind of stuff, which is largely preventative. I mean, this could have been prevented if they had had an assessment. And this is the last one. This is Queensland, Cyclone Debbie, 2017. And again, this one was age connections. There was also a little bit of flooding and surge damage from Debbie. And in Proster Pine, there was some wind damage generally for older structures. But when we talk about all these damages and especially modeling and building codes, again, there's some similarities between the U.S. and Australia. And Australia really ground zero with Cyclone Tracy, right? So 74 hit Darwin. Most people know the story. 70-90% of homes were destroyed. But the bigger kind of industrial buildings that had some engineering input in the design actually did pretty well. And so they said, okay, wow, we need to consider wire houses didn't have any engineering and they didn't do well, and then these other buildings that did performed a lot better. And so that eventually led to the home building code, and then that's why you end up with this kind of 1980s cutoff point for housing when you're modeling, because that's when the code went into effect. Very similar story in the U.S. in the Southeast. So Hurricane Andrew, I was actually in Florida growing up when this happened. 92, peak gusts kind of in the 280 kilometer an hour range, so pretty nasty event, and just kind of total destruction in some of the areas that were hardest hit. And then that led to 2002 building code changes 10 years later, and then that's the line in the sand for vulnerability modeling in the U.S. is that 2002 mark. So very similar to what we do here for the 1980s. And so while that kind of progression was pretty similar, the design concepts that went into those codes are a little bit different. And so the U.S. took this approach to basically say, okay, we're going to protect the building shell, the building envelope. We're going to do a really good job of protecting our windows, our doors, and just the shell of the building in general. There's also plywood decking that goes on top of the rafters, and then the cladding goes on top of that rather than just the cladding on top of battens, as we do here in Australia. And part of the reason for that is because of this internal pressure concept, right? So if a window or a door gets broken open and wind can push into the building, it effectively increases the pressure on the inside, which makes the building push out on itself from the inside. So adding to the load on the structure, kind of in concert with the suction that's already happening outside from the wind. And so you can effectively double the load on the structure if this internal pressure feature occurs, and it happens pretty regularly. So in the U.S., they said, okay, we're going to protect the shell of the building, and we're not going to have to worry so much about this internal pressure, and then that'll be the way that we handle it. In Australia, they went with a different approach in cyclonic areas and basically said, we're going to assume that this dominant opening happens. We're going to assume that a window is broken or a door is broken, and we're going to design the structure of the building to be able to withstand that increase in load. So that's why you have cyclone rods and really strong connections in North Queensland and other cyclone regions, because they're basically saying, we're going to account for that, which is really, really good from a life safety perspective. That's fantastic, right? Because it means that people can stay in those buildings. But unfortunately, that means that over time, the building the buildings in Queensland have become kind of porous on the outside. So from a water ingress standpoint, it's not so great, right? That's not a life safety issue. People are still going to be able to shelter in their homes, but from a loss standpoint, that's really a pretty big issue. So this is a video from TC Debbie. And wind speeds here, I think at this stage in time, maybe category one. I mean, really, we're not talking about a lot of wind. No damage to the exterior of this building. No damage to the track here, and you can see the water coming through. I'm not even quite sure that there was any damage to the roof of this building. It's a multi-story building. But you can see, I don't know, can you see that well? Kind of, yeah. So water coming in through the ceilings, and this is going to be a huge claim. And this is a multi-story building, so you got that water running down through several stories most likely as well. So water ingress is a really, really big issue, especially even for those newer structures that are built to code, right? So when we think about housing performance, age is obviously a really good proxy for housing vulnerability, but it's just a proxy, right? There's a lot more details and things that go into it, and we just use age as kind of an indication of those factors. So when you think about housing performance, so really there's a few different time periods here, and this is just kind of a general representation that I put together. And you actually see houses built before the 1940s perform pretty well, you'll notice, if they're still around. So there's some natural selection there. There's also the fact that a lot of them have historic value, so people actually spend the time and effort to maintain and upkeep them. And they're built with hardier materials, usually. So a lot of these houses were built by hand over a long period of time. And so we actually see that some of these older traditional construction buildings do pretty well compared to some of the newer stuff. Then you have this post-war era construction, right? So we're churning out as many buildings as we can as quick as possible. Not a ton of engineering going into those, and we're just trying to get people places to live, right? Then you have this wake-up call, right? So Cyclone Tracy here, Cyclone Andrew in the U.S., and you know, we lose some lives, and people say, okay, you know, no more, we need to do something about this. And so we strengthen the building codes up to that life safety target. We say we want to protect lives. That's that's one of the four tenets in the Australian Building Code, and it is basically to protect life. And so largely I think we've met that for our newer structures. We've done a pretty good job with those buildings since the 1980s, and especially with the progression after that over the last 20 years. But now what are our goals for the building code, right? So we've accomplished that life safety target. But like I said before, there's some loss issues, some financial loss issues related to how we're designing our buildings that aren't necessarily life safety, but they are causing quite a bit of economic loss. And so there's anytime you increase and make the building code more stringent, there's a cost associated with that. It makes buildings more expensive. So what's the trade-off there between having more expensive buildings and preventing this loss? And so those are some of the key questions that we're kind of wrestling with, I think, going forward, and how we take some of these learnings from cyclones and translate them into codes. And we do a lot of codes and standards work. So that's the future. But then you also still have all of these buildings in the past, right, that aren't even built to that new building code set, so pre-1980s, that aren't even at the current life safety target. And that's really scary. You know, so in Queensland, you're talking about like 60%. You know, that's 60% of homes that 3 out of 5 that are not at the life safety target, and people are a lot of times sheltering in those places, and maybe 40% out in WA. So this is one of the things that we spend a lot of time and research efforts on, is trying to understand how do we retrofit or affect these older buildings that are already constructed, but that aren't at the life safety targets that we need. So that's kind of the context that we look at vulnerability models in. And so we look at it kind of on a single or a typical building type for Queensland approach rather than an actuarial, top-down approach. And there's really four key pieces of information that we look at. They're listed here: the wind data analysis, the post-event damage investigations. We do experimental testing in the lab, and then obviously the claims analysis. All of them have limitations, and really you have to piece all of them together to get a full picture of what the vulnerability is for a building. So starting with the wind analysis, this is just a map of the bomb stations in Queensland, right? So this is the only historical record really that we have for cyclones that cross the coast. This is the only way that we get those damage loss to wind speed relationships. So these are the measurements that we have. And if you look at this 400-kilometer stretch of coastline, there's about 20 stations there. And some of those don't even have anemometers. So as far as historical record goes and being able to create these relationships, we're really, in comparison, this is the same stretch of coastline, about 400 Ks. There's almost 300 stations there in Florida that are measuring, that allow, very higher resolution relationships between damage and wind speed. And so that's really, really important. Not only kind of when you consider the uncertainty with historical records, but in how we're going to handle that and change that in the future. And so one of the programs that we've kind of put together, which Jeremy alluded to a little bit earlier with that movie Twister, is these, it's just called SwirlNet. So it's basically this mobile weather station program that we run out and deploy a bunch of these towers as close as possible to where we think the landfall point is going to be. And we measure wind speed, pressure, all the things that a weather station would do for the most part. Focusing mostly on getting the wind speeds near and in communities of housing. So 3.2 meters is the height there, which is about eave height for a typical building. And we anchor them in with these auger ground screws, and we use a generator to anchor them down in. And we also transmit 10-minute summary data through the Telstra network every 10 minutes so that while the storm is actually going on, we can record and have some sense. It's not high-frequency record of the wind, but it's a summary file that gives us an indication of where the wind speeds are highest and where we might expect the damage to be highest. So emergency services use this kind of stuff in planning recovery, while the event is happening, because they can't get out there to start, making plans. So this program's been around for about 3 years, and so we were out for Debbie. We were out for Ida and Nathan as well. We didn't get down to Marcia. So this information is available, the summary data, for free. It's on the JCU website, Cyclone Testing Station, SwirlNet. And that's one of the ways that we're trying to increase our understanding of wind speed and damage relationships. Then we also have the post-event damage investigation. So this is on-the-ground work. It's not fun, I can tell you that. People have just had their houses destroyed. There's no power. It's just a war zone, and you're walking around kind of, with your notepad, like, hey, really sorry that this happened to you. We're trying to help. Is there, would you mind if we had a look around? Can you tell us a little about what happened? And you hear some really tough stories. But you get a really, really clear picture of the damage, right? So you get a really good idea of forensically why this connection failed or that one, and piecing the puzzle together in detail. On the downside is that you don't have the direct relationship to loss, right? So you guys are all actuaries. You have access to the claims data usually. From a research standpoint, as engineers, we usually are just looking at the damage. And so we don't have that clear connection to financial loss. And obviously it's very time consuming, and you can't do that for every single building. So one of the ways that we get around, the other thing is you can't go back in time, right? So we also can't test solutions in the real world usually. So we use experimental testing to test mitigation solutions, so we can actually pull connections apart, break stuff. We have an impact cannon. We can shoot debris at windows and shutters and that kind of stuff. And then we can change it, tweak it, change the materials, and see how that works and test the effectiveness of that for mitigation solutions. But on the downside, realistic simulation is really hard. So it's really, really complicated and chaotic in the real world. There's all kinds of crazy debris flying around, and you know, you have some connections are aged and some aren't, and you know, some crazy construction guys put in three different random screws that shouldn't have been there, you know, all kinds of stuff like that that in the lab you really just can't recreate. So then the claims analysis gives us a totally different view of the picture. And we've been working a lot with Suncorp over the last few years to help piece together some of their claims data with some of the engineering analysis that we've been doing. And that's really fantastic because we get a direct relationship between damage and loss. But it's really, from the top down, it's really difficult to disaggregate that information and get an understanding of what's actually going on from an engineering standpoint in the building. So this is just a plot of some of the analysis, just really simple plot of some of the analysis we did for Yazzie in the Cassowary Coast region. So this is where landfall happened. Wind speeds were 70 to 95% of the design wind speed for the building. So the column all the way to the right is your modern building code structures. So we were like 70 to 90% of what they were designed for. And you know, what you'll notice is that the difference between newer and older structures isn't that significant. Not as significant as you would have thought, right? And LR is loss ratio, so you're looking at 0 to 10% loss ratio is pretty similar kind of across the board. And then 10 to 50% even is kind of similar. And really, you don't start to see a difference between new and older construction until you get into the really high loss ratios. So that's really where the wind speeds were really high and the roof is getting ripped off, or you know, the building's really kind of falling apart. So you are seeing a difference there, but the majority of claims do not fall within that that really, really high loss ratio component. And then out to the far left kind of demonstrates the point I was making earlier with that traditional construction. So that really old building actually, you know, there's a very small sample set there, but the old buildings that are even, you know, pre-1925s actually perform in some ways better than some of the newer stuff. So some of the key takeaways here and the reasons that those it looks like new or pre-code and post-code buildings are performing similarly. They're really not. It just seems like that because the damage modes are different. So the 1925 to 1981 buildings are at a much higher risk of structural damage because the connections are aged. They don't have the same structural load path that we put in our new buildings. So you're seeing some damage because of that. You're also seeing, you know, maintenance issues and that kind of stuff. But you're seeing so much damage as well in the modern housing because of this water ingress issue. So that's really, really expensive. And newer materials are not built as hardy. So asbestos is actually pretty good at resisting water, right? So we stopped using that, and a lot of other kind of things to optimize the construction process. And so we've in some ways made the loss associated with water ingress in new buildings more of an issue. And then the other kind of key learning for us was that the minor damages are independent of housing age, obviously, but the sheer number of these small claims, it's like 95% of the claims in the area that we looked at were like $5,000 or less. And it's like, when you add it up, it actually becomes a significant amount of loss. And that's the kind of stuff that, so when we talk about changing the vulnerability and actually affecting, you know, trying to decrease it in the future, so there's the roof upgrades, there's protecting the openings, obviously, and then the community outreach and incentives kind of stuff. So picking up the yard, picking up the debris, potential pruning the trees, that kind of stuff makes a pretty big difference in terms of claim volume. And then, one of the things that I've really been focusing on lately is the behavioral side of things. So how do we get people to invest in, a new roof versus a new kitchen, and thinking about these high impact, low probability events and investing in them? How do we make that saleable? And I think originally we thought it was just financial incentive. If the dollars and cents make sense, then they'll do it. But as we start to dig into the behavioral stuff, we're seeing it's a lot more than that. There's actually prior experience with events, how they analyze and assess their risk, what their neighbors are doing, how much they care about their community, and a lot more the hassle factor, how easy it is for them to actually mitigate. Do they know what their options are, that kind of stuff. So we're digging into a lot of that to try and affect change. And I'll cut it there, and probably over time as it is. So.